Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Happy as can be to be here with you. Second hour, Carla Broussard will be here with us. First hour, Joe Heschmeyer. And both hours, you can ask them anything. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, that's what we love talking about. Whether you're Catholic or not, you can call. Whether you're Christian or not, whether you're a religious believer or not, whatever. Anybody can call. 888-318-7884. If you've got a question about Jesus or the church or the sacraments or the moral life of the church, the Bible, you want to know any of it, saints, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour, is the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, which I think is his most popular book, but I will ask him if he knows which is his most popular book. I think it's The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, but he's written
It's actually The Eucharist Is Really Jesus.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, not that I'm against the other book. This is recency bias, perhaps, but I think that book did very well in terms of this past year, with the year for the Eucharistic revival. There was a lot of interest in it. So.
Well, that's good. You tend to have your titles of your books tend to be just a statement of a fact, and yes. I always like the fact. The early church was the Catholic Church. The Eucharist is really Jesus. I like it.
It's like when you bold your thesis statement in college, where you're like, this is it. I made a thesis statement. I put it here. You don't have to wonder where it is.
Here it is.
I'm going to bold it for you.
I'm using graphics as an element of my scholarship.
Exactly.
The number is 888-318-7884. Joe is also the proprietor of Shameless Popery, one of the fastest growing religion or spirituality podcast that I know of. What do you think of that, Joe? What do you think of that endorsement?
That sounds real.
That sounds like a real
hard
thing.
fact to falsify, so yeah. I'll take that.
Well, thanks for being here, Joe. I just want you to know, you probably understand why, but I want to dedicate this show to princesses and construction workers, if you don't mind. Does that make sense to you, Joe?
It does. Wait. Not. Oh, yes, my children, when they had their podcast.
That's funny that I remembered
so
it. You didn't.
It's been so long since that's happened. I was like, this sounds very familiar. Yes, for those listening, my children were really excited to get to use the equipment here. Well, actually, it was at our old place, so it was in the basement. And, you know, they normally were strictly forbidden, but I was like, come on over. I'll show you how everything works. And they decided they wanted to make their own podcast. And they called it the Sutton Podcast, which is confusing because it's named after
their
friends.
The Suttons.
They're not the Suttons. So it's slightly misleading. I mean, I've heard weirder name for podcasts before, but that was. And then they announced that the demographic was construction workers and princesses. Yeah. So I thought, I don't know if there's going to be an episode two. There hasn't been.
That is an overlapping demographic, though. You should see the Venn diagram of the interests of princesses and construction workers. They're fascinated by the same topics. So,
large castles. I think that would be
exactly
of interest to both.
Exactly. Joe, nicely done. 888-318-7884 is the number. I feel ready to go to the phones. Do you feel ready to go to the phones, Joe
Heschmeyer? Let's do it.
All right. In honor of all the princesses and construction workers out there, we begin the show now. Jared in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Jared. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Cy. So I just put on my daughter's tiara just because of that conversation.
Nice.
So
no, that's not that was the only reason why.
You
call.
Just took off your daughter's tiara. Let's be honest. All right. Sorry, Jared. Go ahead.
Okay. So, firstly, Joe, I just wanted to say thank you from my wife, actually, who you spurred a big conversion in her. You were like the first little tipping point from her Baptist raised beliefs to ultimately coming into the church with me. We were both confirmed on the Vigil of Pentecost just
Welcome
a couple months ago. So thank you for that.
That's tremendous.
Thank you. My question regards Jeremiah 6, 2-7, where it talks about the daughter of Zion and her wickedness. So I've seen before, obviously, like Mary is the virgin daughter of Zion, and there are all these like very positive prophecies pointing in that direction, but I had never really seen these negative passages. And I can just imagine that it's an objection. If Mary is sinless and she's the virgin daughter of Zion, why is there all this sort of negative prophetic talking about how the virgin, you know, the daughter of Zion is extremely wicked in Jeremiah?
Yeah. So the phrase daughter of Zion is used to refer to the Israelites, that they are the daughters, as it were, of Zion, meaning like Israel or Jerusalem. So you see throughout the Old Testament, particularly in Isaiah, there's a lot of references to Israel as the daughters of Zion. When it's used positively, then it's often coupled with, you know, the virgin daughter of Zion. But when Israel is going astray, you'll find other descriptives. So, for instance, the captive daughter of Zion, used to describe the Israelites in exile, or in the pejorative way it's being used in Jeremiah 6, just the daughter of Zion kind of going astray. So in all of these, you could replace those with Zion or Jerusalem or Israelites or any of the numerous other terms for the people of God, and they would make sense, both in the positive and negative ways that they're used. The relationship to Mary is that she is, in a certain way, the fulfillment and personification of the messianic people awaiting the Messiah. And so St. Ambrose, for instance, talks about how what you say of Mary, you can say of the church and vice versa. So the church is a virgin and mother is the example that he gives, and Mary's a virgin and mother. Ambrose, for those who don't know, was the great preacher of Milan, Bishop of Milan, who converted St. Augustine in the 300s. This is quite early on still. And in his commentary on Luke, he talks about this, that Mary is kind of an image of the church. So, for instance, when you look at Revelation 12, when you've got the woman enthroned in heaven with a crown of 12 stars, that's a reference to Israel, to the church, to Mary. We would just say, yes, all of the above, that we see a typology and a connection between them, such that you don't want to say either or. That doesn't mean that Israel, Mary, and the church are literally the same. It doesn't mean that there aren't things that could be different about them. And one of the obvious ones is that Israel frequently goes astray, whereas that's not true in the same way for the church, and certainly it's not true for Mary. So the kind of the imagery breaks down at a certain level. Another example when you're talking about this imagery, if you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, when there's the great temple prophecy, the son of David who is to build the temple, in one sense is King Solomon, in another sense, it's Jesus. But some of the imagery used, like God forgiving the sins of the son of David who will build the temple, some of that imagery doesn't apply to Jesus, and other imagery, like establishing the eternal throne, doesn't apply to Solomon. So that's where you hit the limit, where like the same image might have two reference, and it might not perfectly fit just one or the other. There may be kind of an overlap between them.
Okay, Jared?
That sounds great. Hey, last thing, Cy, I just wanted to say to you, because I've been meaning to call in forever, you're such an awesome host, man. Like, you really make this show feel so personal, and like, you know, people who don't even know you just feel like they're friends with you. So just kudos to you. You're such an amazing host.
Thank you. Don't interrupt him, Joe.
That's wonderful.
Do not interrupt him.
I was going to say, you know what? You need to offer him a choice.
Oh, okay. Let's give Jared the choice. Jared, that is very kind. First of all, quite sincerely, that's a beautiful thing to say, and thank you very much for it. I'd like to give you a book. Would you like a book about Jesus or a book about Peter?
Let's go. So if it's Joe's books, I have every single one of them.
Okay. That's still not an answer, though. I need an answer from you.
Oh, okay, okay. Let's go Jesus.
Okay, that's the correct answer. Because if you say Jesus, you get two books. But you already got Joe's book, so you can give a copy of the Pope Peter book to someone else, or just have it in reserve for when you need to punish your children. My book is called... Oh, wait a second. That didn't come out right. My book is called A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him. And you can have that book and Joe's, Pope Peter... Give me the subtitle, Joe, because I'll mess it
defending
up.
Defending the church's most distinctive doctrine in a time of crisis.
All right. Jared's my favorite caller today. Hang on the line, Jared. We want to give you those two books. We will be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1982. Mother Angelica presents Pope John Paul II with a model of EWTN's first satellite dish. "I have heard about you," the Pope said. "You do good work." A photo of the meeting and the Pope's words are of great help to the fledgling network.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884, the number. There's one line open. Joe Heschmeyer's here, and you can ask him anything. That really was a nice call. Jared, awful nice guy. And also,
yeah, it really was.
Yeah, and the two of them came into the church this year. That's beautiful. Let's go to Ellen in New Iberia, Louisiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Ellen, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love y'all. Anyway, okay, we're going to start Bible study pretty soon, and we're going to go through Exodus, and one of the things is God saying, you know, with the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." So I want to know about that.
Wonderful. I don't know. I've actually moved you up the list when I saw your call. Because I had just, when I say just, I mean like about 5 minutes before I needed to get on the call for the show, I had just been putting together biblical stuff on this because I'm going to cover this in a podcast in about a week. So I was very excited to think, I have all those verses right in front of me. That in Exodus, we're actually given a very complex picture of Pharaoh's heart being hardened. So if we ask who hardened Pharaoh's heart, some verses just say, in the passive, like Pharaoh's heart was hardened, like Exodus 7:13 and Exodus 7:22, Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. Other verses, as you say, sounds like God is hardening Pharaoh's heart. For instance, Exodus 9:12, "But the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh." But then you also have these same passages, like Exodus 8:32, where it says Pharaoh hardened his heart. So you can find the hardening of the heart of Pharaoh referred to in all three different ways. In fact, I don't know if you have a pen, but the one to keep track of is at the end of Exodus 9, beginning of Exodus 10. So it's as the seventh plague is ending and right before the 10th plague, there is a series of three verses in a row where we're told what appear to be three different answers to this question. So in Exodus 9, verse 34, "When Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart, he and his servants." So it sounds very clearly, okay, this is Pharaoh's doing. Verse 35, the very next verse, "So the heart of Pharaoh was hardened." Okay, so in the passive, so can't say. The very next verse is actually the next chapter, Exodus 10:1. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants.'" So it just said two verses prior to that Pharaoh and his servants hardened their hearts, their own hearts. And then it sounds like God's doing it. So how can all of that be true? The Baptist preacher Charles Spurgeon gave a beautiful example that I regularly go back to for this, where he said, "The same sun which melts wax hardens clay. And the same gospel which melts some persons to repentance hardens others in their sins. So it is not that God is hardening Pharaoh's heart in the way that he's taking away Pharaoh's free will. No, Pharaoh is hardening his own heart in response to God's action. That's actually very clear, even in Exodus 9:34, when we're told that when Pharaoh saw what? That the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased. So God stops the seventh plague, God acts, and Pharaoh responds to that by refusing to obey. If you're not going to punish me, I'm going to just go right back to disobedience. That is, on the one hand, Pharaoh freely hardening his own heart. On the other hand, we can talk about that as God hardening Pharaoh's heart, because it was God's action, in this case, stopping the plagues, that led Pharaoh to respond in the kind of hateful way that he did. So we can talk about it in both senses. This is one of the things we want to recognize, that God is sovereign even in the things that he lets us do, even things he doesn't want us to do, but then permits us to do nevertheless. He's still in authority. He could have struck you dead before you sinned. So he permits you to sin, but he doesn't do your sinning for you. So God doesn't harden Pharaoh's heart in the sense that God makes Pharaoh be disobedient or something. It wouldn't be disobedience if he's just doing what God wants him to do. I don't know. Does that help clarify?
Yes. I had heard this years ago, and I just wanted, I knew it, God was not doing this. So this, I think, I scribbled some notes very quickly. So I think
the end of Exodus 9, top of Exodus 10.
Right.
And then the sun hardening clay and melting wax. Those two things would be the takeaways, I think.
Yes, and that it is, God is not taking away his free will.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
All right, Ellen.
All righty. God be praised. Thank you.
Amen to that. Yeah. Thank you very much, Ellen. Let's go to Emma. Oh, old friend Emma in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. Emma, welcome back. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you so much, Cy. But first, Joe, your podcast, the one on the in vitro fertilization, is incredible. I had no idea. It was. Everyone needs to listen to that.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope everyone listening to this takes you after the show, obviously.
Right. I'll tell you what, Emma, thank you for saying that. I'll tell people where they can listen to it when you and Joe are done talking. I'll make sure that don't apologize. I'm grateful for what you said.
Bully you for saying nice things about my show.
I was trying to be helpful. Oh, my goodness. All right. They're all against me.
Okay,
all right, go ahead, Emma.
I've got a big confession. I cheated on you guys. I was listening to another Christian radio station.
That's okay.
And it was Patrick Madrid, and somebody asked him about Jesus because they wanted to know what he was like, you know, comparing him to the Chosen. And Patrick said that he wouldn't be as jovial as predicted. He thinks, you know. So I want to know, did Jesus have a sense of humor?
Yeah. So I would say yes. But that when we talk about humor, so there's a certain element of humor that can rely on surprise. And it's difficult to know how something like that would work with Jesus in line of omniscience. That gets into a much deeper question about modes of knowledge in terms of somebody like playing a joke on Jesus. But he seems to have, he certainly seemed to have a sense of humor for one. I mean, I guess I always go back to the fact that, like, the platypus exists, which seems to suggest a divine sense of humor. That, you know, you have these sort of silly creatures that just seem like there's a certain levity, even in creation. But then also, if you look at Jesus' language, now, he's never trivial. So I have only watched a little bit of The Chosen, so I can't give you, like, a comparison point. But sometimes when we talk about a sense of humor, we mean a sort of irreverence or a sort of vacuousness where we don't take reality seriously. And it does not seem like Jesus has a sense of humor in that sense at all. Nevertheless, he does say things that are quite clever, or even like, calling Herod a fox. It shows a certain habit of mind or a certain disposition where there's a mental sharpness there that is kind of witty. So I think it'd be much easier to talk about Jesus being quite witty in just terms of his brilliance. Whereas sense of humor, I think, yes, in one sense, but it depends heavily on what we mean by that. I don't want to say more than kind of the picture of Jesus we get in the New Testament. Because I think people are very quick to say, well, the Jesus in my imagination is X, Y, and Z. It's like, okay, fine, but that's not the concern. The concern is the real Jesus, not the version you've invented in your own head.
Okay, that sounds very logical. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks, and we love Patrick Madrid.
He's great.
He's wonderful.
I know you do.
Yeah. Thanks, Emma. Let me tell folks, shamelessjoe.com, you can go to shamelessjoe.com, and then you just scroll down, I don't know, it'll be about halfway down the page, and then Unmasking the Horrors of IVF. It was posted on August 1st. There's so many good things here, but the one that Emma was just talking about is called Unmasking the Horrors of IVF. Go ahead and find it there, and sign up and be a Patreon sponsor of Joe's podcast if you want as well, shamelessjoe.com. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We now go to Caesar in Odessa, Texas, watching on YouTube. Is that how you pronounce it? Do you say Caesar?
Yeah, Caesar, like the salad. Not what I
normally like the people. Salad. Okay. Not like the emperor, like the salad. All right. Okay, Caesar.
A2.
All right, Caesar, go ahead with your question.
Hey, Joe. I just want to say love the podcast. Hi. Listen to it every day, every Tuesday and Thursday at work. Just had a question. A few months ago, you did a pair of episodes about the Virgin Mary, and they were great. But one thing that got me thinking was that I guess her comparison as the new Adam and Eve with Jesus as mother and son and not as husband and wife. Do we have an idea of why that is a change or that or a stronger relationship? What do we have for that reason?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the first thing is Adam and Eve are unique in the fact that while they are husband and wife, Eve also comes from Adam because, you know, she's taken from the side of Adam. So it's a slightly more complicated relationship in that sense. She has, if you want to describe it as a miraculous birth or a miraculous creation in some sense, I think you could call it that. Unlike Adam, who is not taken from any prior human, Eve comes from one human, biologically speaking, right? I mean, obviously not in the ordinary course of biology, but the biblical account presents Eve in this kind of unique way. It's coming from just Adam. Well, in a sort of reversal of this in some way, Christ also only has one human biological source, his mother. Whereas, you know, everybody else has two parents, or in the case of Adam, no parents. Jesus and Eve are the two with one. So I think that one aspect of it is probably right there, that you get the Genesis 3:15 foretells how the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. And so this is considered to be the first prophecy of the virgin birth, that you're measuring the seed not through the man, but through the woman. The seed was always measured through the man, basically. The only exception being once in regard to which mother of Abraham's children we're talking about. Every other time in the Old Testament, the seed is measured through the man. And yet here, the description is not the seed of Adam or anything like this. But Genesis 3:15 talks about the devil being at war with the woman and her seed. And so this is considered the Protoevangelium, you know, the first gospel, this first prediction of the virgin birth. The second thing, though, is that when we talk about the imagery, Mary as the new Eve, I don't know if you heard, three calls ago, I mentioned to a caller Ambrose's line that what we say of Mary, we say of the church and vice versa. So we talk about both Mary and the church in this context of being the new Eve. And part of the reason for that is for a period of time, to the extent you could talk about a Christian church on earth during that first period before the first Christmas, Mary was the only member of the church for a while. Now, I mean, we're using church in a slightly, you know, obviously Christ hadn't formed the church in that sense. But in terms of followers of Christ, it's just Mary. And so it's fitting that we connect what we say about Mary with what we say about the church. And so we can also talk about the church as the new Eve. And so St. Paul uses some of this language, talking about the church as the bride of Christ, like in Ephesians 5, and talking about the church being betrothed to the new Adam. So that language of the new Eve, he also applies that to the church, but it's not an either or. So the church, we use more of the bridal imagery for, obviously, not for Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Okay, Caesar?
That makes sense, Caesar?
Yes, that
Caesar?
Makes sense.
Sorry.
All right.
Okay, great.
Well, there's the music, so I will thank you very much for the call. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Eucharist is Really Jesus, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, Pope Peter, all very popular books, and also the proprietor of the very popular podcast and YouTube channel, Shameless Popery. Find it at shamelessjoe.com. Right back with more questions for Joe after this on Catholic Answers Live. As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Do you have a junk drawer?
That's tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Joe Heschmeyer, our guest next hour. Dr. Carlo Broussard will be here, and we will continue with the Ask Me Anything. If you've got questions about the Catholic faith, whether you are a person of faith or a person of no faith, you're welcome to call and ask your question, 888-318-7884. We've got a gentleman in studio for a question for Joe. As soon as I do this, come to our conference. We want you to come to the conference. Joe's going to be there. All of our apologists will be there. Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Carlo Broussard, Tim Staples. We'll do a live radio show from there. And we've got some of just the best guests you could want to come and talk about the words, the sayings, the parables, the conversations of Jesus Christ, including the inimitable. I will use the word inimitable to refer to Dr. Ray Guarendi. And Kimberly Hahn will be there. Dr. Scott Hahn will be there. Come on. It's going to be a great time. Go to CatholicAnswersConference.com and find out all about it. It's September 26th through 28th right here in sunny San Diego. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Just to the south of us. If you head down the 25 freeway, That's what we call freeways here in California, the 25. That's how you're supposed to say it. The 25, because we're Californians.
You come. But you also say freeway and not highway.
What? Oh, the 125? Oh, sorry. It's the 125. All right. I was in the ballpark. All right. Don't correct me when I'm in the middle of making important mistakes. If you go down the 125, you come to Chula Vista, and that's where Noah lives. Noah, thanks for coming in.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. My question was, how were disagreements settled in the early church? So I know I kind of like read about Origen of Alexandria, and he kind of had, I guess, like a disagreement where he believed that God was incorporeal. I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but how were disagreements like that, settled?
Yeah, it's a good question. So part of it is the process of settling theological questions sometimes goes slowly. You know, we can look back at an issue and say, oh, great. You know, they got this thing hammered up by, 250. And it's like, yeah, but if you were living in, the year 200 and you're like, how has this not been settled? You know, you've got people going around saying crazy things. Why haven't they been corrected yet? It probably felt very slow. We have the kind of benefit of hindsight in looking back. So I'd say this. The church has the ability to come together at ecumenical councils, for instance, and settle major doctrinal questions. But the first time, so you've got the Council of Jerusalem, where you see that happening in Acts 15. Mm-hmm. The next time the church does that is in 325 mm-hmm. at the First Council of Nicaea. So in a lot of cases, it was a much more kind of on the ground, working it out sort of thing, where if somebody said something heretical, you would just cut them off from communion. You would say, all right, well, we no longer consider you a practicing Christian, or we don't consider you a Catholic. And so we don't invite you to receive communion in our church anymore. Or they would be, you know, laicized in some cases if you had priests who were saying something heretical. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it kind of works out at that more local level, which can work really effectively if things are working well kind of at the local level. But occasionally you'd have these issues arise where there is maybe a question of jurisdiction, for instance. So I know that during the lifetime of Jerome, while he's there in Bethlehem, there are disputes about who should be ordaining priests and who has permission from the appropriate bishop to do that. And all of these kind of important juridical questions can pop up. So whether we're talking about theological issues or just kind of issues of governance, the church has a mechanism by which to solve these things. Mm-hmm. But if we're imagining it's a simple matter of, okay, here's a problem, I'm going to snap my fingers and everything's going to be clarified, That won't be how it works. It's going to be a much slower, much more deliberative process, partly because more than once in the life of the church, people jumped at the idea that somebody else was speaking heretically when, upon further reflection, they really weren't speaking heretically. They were maybe speaking imprecisely, or more frequently were just using different language. So there was this whole debate about whether Jesus has a divine and human nature as two natures, or whether we talk about one nature in Jesus. And increasingly, I think as the centuries have gone on, what looked like a really clear-cut disagreement was probably a lot more complicated, where what the two sides even meant by the word nature might not have been the same, and that the people saying Jesus had one nature were probably trying to say that he is one person, to use our way of speaking about it. And so you can have those kind of things. So for this reason, I think the church is often very slow in cracking down on false opinions until it becomes much clearer, like, nope, that is definitely, like, you are saying something untrue, and the bad fruits of a bad opinion can become clear over time as well. To give one more example here, I know I'm kind of belaboring this with historical examples, but Pelagius denies original sin, which maybe doesn't sound that bad, depending on what you think about the doctrine of original sin, but it leads him to this place where he thinks, well, we could be perfect if we just tried really hard. So now the denial of original sin has turned into a denial of the need for grace. And that then turns into the idea that Jesus is helpful. He's important in that sense, but we could kind of have done it without him. So now you've gone from this, you know, seemingly less important issue of original sin to downplaying the necessity of Jesus Christ. now it's clear that there's a really serious, really big problem here. So that's when, you know, when those kind of things bear fruit and then it's a wicked fruit, the church cracks down much more aggressively there.
Okay. All right, Noah, you look like you have a follow-up.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like if they, let's say they were like to be heretical and they would like be cut off, how would the church try to maintain unity? Like,
yeah, so it depends. If it's an individual thinker or set of thinkers, they would just excommunicate them. And then the expectation would be you would do penance and be reunited with the church. It's a bigger issue when it's an entire church, you know, like the entire church in Alexandria, say. Then you have sometimes you have these schisms where entire churches will break off. And those are a lot harder to heal. It's actually much easier to handle the situation when it's one individual or a small group of people. But when an entire church is going astray, that's when things can be really difficult to solve and to heal. That's an ongoing issue where the church is still, in some cases, trying to heal 1,600-year-old wounds, like, for instance, with the Oriental Orthodox, the Coptic churches.
Yeah. Noah, thank you for coming in.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Do you want any of Joe's books before you go home?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that was the right answer, Noah. That would have been very awkward if you said no.
No.
They'll help you out there. Maybe Edgar will help you when you go out there. Thank you, Noah. Right. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you again, Si. Thank you again, Joe.
All right. Yeah. On we go. Well, we'll go to Alabama now. Daniel in... Whoa, hang on. It's okay. We're still tied to the microphone here, and Noah's leaving. Daniel in Alabama, watching on YouTube. Thanks very much, Daniel, for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the Eucharist. I have the Protestant object, on a YouTube video, object to how we understand the Eucharist being Jesus in relation to, you know, the logic of the Last Supper or the Passover with the Israelites, where they had the lamb and the bread and the wines, and they were kind of, you know, throwing shade on how, why do we say, well, we just need the bread, and that is Jesus, when there was the lamb present at the Last Supper and at Passover's, you know, years before, too.
Yeah. I think that the observation of the lamb is actually an argument in favor of the Catholic position. Before I get there, I want to give a quick, I guess, advertisement. Ferris from How to Be Christian has a part two of his series of What Does Jesus Mean in John 6. And I just watched it today, and I thought he did a good job of pretty charitably answering both good and bad Protestant objections on this kind of question of what does Jesus mean both at John 6, and then what does he mean at the Last Supper when he tells us to eat his flesh and drink his blood. But to get to the question, when we have the Last Supper, none of the biblical accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and St. Paul and 1 Corinthians, all tell us about the Last Supper. And at the center of this, which is explicitly a Passover meal. Now, the ordinary Passover meal, the center of the Passover meal, even though it's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the main course, as it were, was the sacrificial lamb. And yet, in none of these four New Testament accounts of the Christian Passover at the Last Supper, is there one word said about lamb being present at all. Now, I don't see any way that disproves the Eucharist. It seems to me that the obvious point there is that at the center of the Christian Eucharist is the Lamb of God, is Jesus Christ himself. And if that wasn't clear enough from the mere absence of any kind of animal in the descriptions of the Last Supper in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and 1 Corinthians, there's also the fact that in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul explicitly calls Jesus our Passover lamb. And so given that, we would say, yeah, we are receiving the lamb. When we eat the flesh and drink the blood, we are not receiving just bread and wine, but the Lamb of God himself. So that the Lamb of God really is present at every Christian Eucharist, at every commemoration of the Last Supper. What would you say, Daniel?
I think that's a good explanation. I think it's hard for non-Catholics to wrap their head around it in general. So it's an uphill battle, I think, to try and explain it to a Protestant that's refusing to, you know, accept anything you're saying. So.
Well, I guess I would kind of turn the question around and say, well, do you eat Passover lamb every time you celebrate the Lord's Supper?
True.
Because I don't, you know, because the question should be, well, is the Christian Eucharist intended to be in some way like prefigured by the Last Supper? Or, excuse me, by the Passover. And it should be very clear. Matthew 26, when it describes the Last Supper, in verse 17 and 18 and 19, describes it explicitly as the Passover. So it is the Christian Passover. Three times we're told that. And yet it doesn't have the Passover lamb, the most important part of the meal from a Jewish perspective, unless the lamb is Jesus himself.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. You know, good. Daniel, I think maybe the Eucharist is really Jesus is the book for you. And if you'd like it, I'll send it to you. Edgar will send it to you. Just hang on. He'll get your information and send it off. We have to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I just want to thank the station for being there on the radio for all of us Catholics. We're all trying to learn something new every day about ourselves and about the world we live in and the people that we interact with. Thank you for taking my question. I appreciate your willingness to be on the radio these days.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest this hour. Next hour, Dr. Carla Broussard will be here. We'll continue with Ask Me Anything. And you are welcome to call. There's one line open right now, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Going to Malachi in Alabama, watching on YouTube. Malachi, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thank you for taking my question. My question was about Saint Anna, I believe the mother of Mary, and I had a question I just wanted a brief overview of who she is and how it's trustworthy to pray to her as a saint.
Oh yeah, so basically we know very little in terms of concrete historical information about Mary's parents. She certainly seems to have been well-raised. And we can safely deduce that these were pious, holy parents. But we're not actually given any information about them at all in the New Testament. And so we have a lot of stories about them. And it's these stories, things like the Proto-Evangelium of James, that give us the names that we use for them, Joachim and Anne. But even that information, we don't necessarily know that we're even getting the names right. But it's not, I guess, as important to get the details. Like, we know that Jesus had grandparents. We know they raised Mary, and we're grateful to them for that. And, so we ask for their intercession and for their prayers that they'll pray to their grandson. More than that, we get into the realm of what's called pious opinion, where it's, you know, you're free to believe a certain thing happened, but you're not required to believe that. And so there are plenty of stories about what they were like, but we don't have any great detail of reliability any great degree of reliability with that we would say, oh yeah, you have to believe, you know, X, Y, or Z about them.
Okay, Malachi?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I was just curious as to their origin because, you know, a lot of Protestants will hear something that's not in the Bible and then just dismiss it as something Gnostic or something like that. So I was just curious.
No, I mean, the fact that Mary has parents and they're holy and all of that, I wouldn't say that's Gnostic at all. I think this is part of, unfortunately, many Christians are unaware of any early Christian writings outside of the New Testament. And so if they know about any, they only know about like the heretical ones. So they get very nervous about anything that's, you know, an early Christian story or an early Christian commentary or an early Christian theologian. And there's, in fact, a great richness that we could learn from if we had more curiosity and more humility.
It's a funny thing that, like, if someone writes a Christian book today, we go, oh, that's a great Christian book. But if somebody wrote a Christian book in the first century, we go, oh, that's not in the Bible.
Right.
That's a weird...
It's a very strange standard. Like, it's either in the Bible or it's worthless. And I'm like, I'm glad my books are not held to that standard.
Yeah. Are your books held to a standard? Okay, anyway, Malachi.
Now you're attacking our editor.
Oh, thanks very much, Malachi. Appreciate the call. On we go to Texas. Am I going to the right place? Terry in Texas watching on YouTube? Yeah, I think I guess I am.
Yeah.
Well, now I've said it, so yeah. I got to it. Terry, welcome.
Yeah. Hi, thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, I wanted to know how I respond to my Protestant friend when she's very troubled that we drink wine and consider it Jesus' blood when God says in the Old Testament in Leviticus, that the Israelites are not to drink blood.
Yes. I'm going to be totally honest with you. I find that objection very funny, as if the reason we wouldn't drink human blood is primarily because it's not kosher. I imagine that even if there wasn't about not drinking human blood, we still wouldn't do it. I think this is actually one of those arguments that works better for the Catholic side in two ways. Number one, Jesus says you have to gnaw his flesh and drink his blood in John 6. Like he says, eat my flesh, eat my flesh, eat my flesh. When the people say, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Rather than Jesus saying it's all a metaphor, he doubles down. He switches the verbiage from to eat to gnaw. And then he adds the language of and drink my blood, which is a horrifying image if it's a metaphor. Like if you're a Protestant who says, oh, this is all a big metaphor, I can kind of get how, oh, we really have to chew on Jesus's words. You know, then fine. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. I can buy that as a figure of speech. But when he says you have to gnaw his flesh and drink his blood, what metaphor is he using there? And so it's very easy to say it's a metaphor and very hard to say a metaphor for what? Like that part always seems people get strangely quiet about that. But in any case, in Leviticus, the reason you couldn't drink animal blood, we're told explicitly, Leviticus 17, for the life of every creature is the blood of it. In other words, to drink the blood of an animal was viewed as entering into communion with the animal. And it was unholy for you to want to enter into communion with a cow. But it is holy to want to enter into communion with God. And so the same reason you wouldn't drink the blood of an animal, you would drink the blood of God. Hmm. What would you say to that?
Oh, I say that sounds right on.
Terry? I talk about this in my book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. So if you want to stick around, we will send you a copy of that.
Hang on, Terry. Edgar will help you out. If you'd be willing to give us an address, we'll send you a copy of Joe's book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. Going to now Fairmont, Minnesota, to speak with Grady, our old friend Grady in Fairmont, Minnesota, whose name I always say correctly, Grady. Nice to talk with you, Grady.
Well, thank you very kindly. That was a good introduction there. Thank you.
Thank you. What, do you know why I went into such great detail?
I do.
Okay.
I mean,
all right.
I think I was there for the event.
All right.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure. Oh, I'm there for lots of events I don't remember the next
good
day.
Good gravy, you too.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I know. Hey, my question, Joe, for you is, I was talking with another Catholic today about the rite of peace during the Mass. And it's a question I've never really pondered before. Why is it where it is during the Mass? And kind of a follow-up to that is, was it something that was there before Vatican II, or was it something that was added because of Vatican II? And where would we find the document why it was added, if that was the case?
Yeah, so when we talk about the sign of peace being given, there's really three places you can look to for New Testament support. Christ's Last Supper, saying, "My peace I give you, my peace I leave with you." That is the primary kind of biblical text. And since that's happening around the institution of the Eucharist, that's where it appears in the Mass. But we're also told to greet one another with a holy kiss. And we're told if we have a disagreement with our neighbor, we should confess it to them and sort things out before we present our gifts at the altar. So those are the three biblical kind of rationales for why you would have a sign of peace. One is a sign of greeting. So that kind of obnoxious, everybody stand up and greet your neighbor before Mass thing is sort of biblical. It is pretty annoying. So I'm with everybody who's like, please don't do that. But there is this sense in which we should be warm and welcoming. I don't think that's what's intended when St. Paul says that, but there's a basis for that. Ratzinger, before he became Pope Benedict XVI, argued that there's a legitimate reason we could move the sign of peace earlier to the end of the Liturgy of the Word and before the offertory, because of Jesus's instructions about making peace with our neighbor before we bring our gifts to the altar. But the current location of it is the oldest. And it was before Vatican II, although before Vatican II, the way it worked in the traditional Latin Mass is the priest would give peace to everyone, and then he would give a sign of peace to the deacon, who would give a sign of peace to the subdeacon, and then kind of go down from there. So the image was peace flowing from the altar, because it's the peace of Christ. So there it wasn't about us just making peace one with another, but the peace that only Jesus can bring being kind of flowing, as it were, from the altar. In the first or in the second century, in like the 150s, maybe 160s, St. Justin Martyr writes in First Apology about the order of the Mass. And there he talks about this. He talks about it in chapter 65, right before the distribution of the Eucharist. He talks about how, having ended the prayers, we salute one another with a kiss. There is then brought to the president and the presider of the brethren bread and a cup of wine mixed with water. So he has it, I believe, actually right before the institution of the Eucharist. So it changed somewhat in its location. And I think Ratzinger's argument was we could go back to that spot. But it depends on whether you're trying to show the peace of Christ flowing from the altar, or whether you're trying to show the peace we have one with another before we present our gifts at the altar.
Does that work? That work for you, Grady?
Yeah, that was fantastic. Yes, thank you very much for the explanation.
Okay,
yeah, right. Absolutely. Let's go to Hayden in Boise, Idaho, on line one.
Hayden in Boise, Idaho, go ahead with your question, but it's going to have to be quick for Joe.
Okay, hi there.
Hi.
My girlfriend and I, we just started having the religion talk. She's a Bible alone Protestant. She goes to a non-denominational church. And she was basically saying that, like, certain traditions we have in the church aren't biblical and there's no reason we should do them, if anti-Bible or whatever. So I told her to find a verse or something in the Bible that says the only way to be Christian is to only believe in the Bible, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And she pulled out a verse from 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6, about how not to believe beyond what is written. Mm-hmm. And I just... it didn't make sense to me, like me myself. It didn't, like, it confused me a little bit, but I've had thoughts like not everything in Christianity has been written down.
I got to let Joe try to answer Hayden, because we're just running out of time.
Okay, Hayden. So I've got to answer it very quickly because we're running up against the time. That's not what St. Paul's talking about, and you can prove that in a really easy way. At the time 1 Corinthians is written, most of the New Testament hasn't been written yet. Almost everybody agrees on that. And so if Paul is saying literally only believe things written down, he'd be telling you not to believe in the things yet unwritten in the New Testament, like the Gospels. So that's not what he means. It's the verse is being taken out of its context.
Hayden, I got to leave it there. I'm sorry we had to be so quick with you. We were right up against the clock. Joe Heschmeyer, shamelessjoe.com. You should check it out. Everybody else is. It's really growing in popularity. Joe, thanks very much for a very fine hour.
My pleasure.
Dedicated to princesses and construction workers. Next hour, we're going to continue. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, there's two lines open right now, 888-318-7884. Dr. Carlo Broussard right after this on Catholic Answers Live.